Hello everyone, Tiffany here with Stephen, and you are here with us on another episode of the Deep Dive Podcast.
That's right, we're back diving into the action, because last week we unpacked some of the announcements that Prime Minister and Minister for Finance Lawrence Wong unveiled in this year's budget. So if you missed that episode, you can go back and have a listen before watching this week's episode.
Yeah, we spoke extensively about jobs and AI, but now that a week has passed, you know, we've also had some time to think about it, you know, read all the commentary, opinions that have come out. I think we want to get a deeper understanding of, you know, what goes behind the government's thinking when they are laying out, you know, certain things in the budget.
Right, because we've been hearing AI, and some people are going, but what's all this AI about?
And how much AI do I need?
I know, what's it going to mean for me? So that's what we want to dive into today. We have a special guest with us. He wears many hats. He's the Acting Minister for Transport, Senior Minister of State for Finance, and also co-chairs the Economic Strategic Review Committee on Global Competitiveness. So, Minister Jeffrey, welcome.
Very happy to be here.
Let's talk about AI first. Let's just dive straight in, right? Because it was a key component of the budget speech, and it's also a very key emphasis of the ESR's recommendations. So even if we are not using it at work, many people would have, you know, somehow experimented with AI. So what's your sense of where we are at now in terms of overcoming the challenges that, you know, we have when it comes to AI?
Well, AI is definitely the thing that caught the attention of most people of the budget statement. I think the best way to sort of explain this is just to draw a parallel with the internet. If I can just take you back to 1993, the internet was, well, sort of just born. There were 100 websites then. 1996, we had 100,000 websites. So you could kind of see the shape of it. The internet was going to change the world, but actually you didn't really know how exactly, because in 1996, Google was just a two-man startup. It wasn't even there yet. Fast forward to today, 2022, ChatGPT was first launched. Now, 3 years later, we are in here, 2026, roughly about 3 years. There are more AI clients now. You could kind of see the shape. You can see the shape of what AI is going to do, but actually, we don't really know what's going to happen. Exactly. So we are all at the starting line, really, of what's going to happen.
And but at the same time, the growth is exponential. I mean, we're talking about the internet bubble. It took years to evolve slowly. This one, bam! You know what I mean? AI is moving so
quickly.
Well,
if you look back at that time, it wasn't a slow boil either, the internet. There was the internet bubble precisely because everybody was so excited about it. And I think for the AI revolution, it will be like this. There will be ups and downs, but the key is now I think we're all pretty sure that we're on to something big. The AI is going to transform not just the economy, but also society.
So there is a lot of concern from what people see on the ground. Now, PM also did focus on four sectors for AI-led transformation: manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, connectivity, finance, healthcare. So why the emphasis on these areas?
I think the first thing is that it's perfectly natural for people to feel all sorts of different emotions about AI, because it's so new. You are excited, you're curious. Some people are worried and anxious. All very understandable, because it's all new to us. And it is because AI has such a wide-ranging effect. And what we want to do is be at the starting line, get Singaporeans familiar with AI to get used to it, so that you're warmed up, ready to go. And when AI comes and it affects your job, your circumstance, You're ready to embrace it, and you know, can adapt and do what it takes to get you to where you want to go.
But why these four sectors, though? I mean, like, why not, I guess, entertainment, you know? The media,
come on,
aerospace.
How to replace us?
Not yet. But yeah, so why these four sectors? Why so specific into these four sectors?
Well, it is a start. Actually, the way these four sectors are scoped, they are very broad. When I say advanced manufacturing, actually, there are lots of things that can be advanced manufacturing. But what we see is that these are the four sectors that are, number one, very important to Singapore, because they are a big part of our economy today. Number two, it is where there are lots of innovations that are currently happening. For example, in semiconductors, which is part of advanced manufacturing, you can see lots of applications of AI sort of manifesting themselves. Connectivity is the same thing. You can see AI being applied in logistics, in air, sea transport, in land transport, where autonomous vehicles have come on board precisely because AI have been applied. So lots of things are happening, and we want to make sure that we understand it, work with the companies to bring in AI into their business, and also reshape the way we run the industry here, whether it's in regulations or laws or, you know, companies that are here, to reshape it so that we can make sure that those industries adopt AI comprehensively.
I almost feel like AI is this tool we want to have where at the end of the day, it will be almost be seamless. Like now, we never think about using our phone for so many things. AI will become part and parcel of our life. Mm. But at the same time, when we talk about this strategy by the government, at what point do we say, okay, I've achieved it? How are we going to measure our ROI, our returns on investment? How are we going to say, yes, AI is now a part of our economy and we live with it?
I think if you think that we have, can call ourselves an AI empowered nation, an AI enabled economy, I think that's where we will probably say, okay, we are there. We are not going to be able to compete with the US and China in terms of building, say, foundational models. We're just not, we don't have the scale, we don't have the resources to do that sort of thing. But what we want to do is to be very disciplined and focused in our AI strategy. We are going to invest in R&D. We are going to bring talent from all over the world to Singapore. We are going to come up with interesting problem statements that talent will want to come and work with us. And this speaks to AI missions and the four sectors that we talked about. What we want to do is to uplift all our SMEs, make sure that they benefit from and adopt AI. But finally, after that, I want to get all Singaporeans to be familiar with AI. And that's why we're making it very easy for Singaporeans to do AI training and take AI training courses through SkillsFuture.
So I want to follow on that, because you mentioned that the first step really is to become a hub that is so attractive for AI talent to come to us.
Yes.
Then at the same time, I'm seeing that if I am just a citizen, I just need to adopt AI, I just need to be literate in AI. Won't there be a sudden big gap between the people that you're trying to attract and then the people like me, who I may not be an innovator, I may not be a talent in that space? Will that, in that sense, make Singaporeans feel, hey, are we kind of going to be left behind, you know, in this race to try and be an AI hub?
Yeah, no, I can understand that sentiment. But if you look at how we have adopted sort of technologies in the past, there's a whole range of different dispositions, from people who are fast adopters to people who are then at the end and they still benefit from it, but only at the later stage. And it depends on where you are in, you know, some of it depends on how young you are. I was just at the SMRT depot just now, and they were showing us some of the tech tools that we're doing. And we asked them, you know, are you using AI for this? And their response was, yeah, the younger guys are doing it. And so there's different degrees, I think, even within our population, people who use AI in different intensities. But there is the energy we want to get everybody to adopt even the basic users of simple ChatGPT tools, for instance. And as long as we sort of get everybody on board, I think we can make some progress.
At the same time, I think it's unrealistic to expect that everyone will be AI savvy. You know what I mean? And that's not the purpose of it. But, you know, from what you're saying, it sounds like we just want people to be aware, know how it works, what it can do. Because we've had interns come to us and say, in university, they all minor in AI anyway. They all use it for all their assignments and things like that. So for that generation, they're not too concerned. Mm. And their level up will be much smaller than someone who in the older generation. Yeah. So I guess, is it important to really make it so relevant to everyone, or are we accepting the fact that some older folks will retire without knowing very much AI and be comfortable and happy? Maybe he just needs to use it to, when he's living, to press a button and it will do a bunch of stuff for him so that the food comes faster or something like that,
or
you know,
come up
right?
With like nice good morning memes.
To actively engage them, talking to them in their unit, you know,
I mean, it may well be. I mean, basically, as I said, I think we are all at the starting line. The vast majority of humankind is at the starting line of what AI can do.
Really? And the vast majority?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we can see the shape of how AI is going to change the world, but I don't know if we can say for sure that this is how things will change and this is how my job is going to be in the future. So there is a lot of, I suppose, things that we cannot predict, but the most important thing is to get everybody ready. Get everybody excited, warmed up, ready to go when the time comes that you're going to have to do something, you know how to do it.
So let me put it this way then. At which point will you say, I'm okay, we've arrived. Mm. When your uncle, auntie will come to you and say, hey, minister, now I can, you know.
How many years do you think we will get there?
Well, I think if they can show me something and tell me this is AI and this is not real, I think I will be very assured that's a good outcome.
But that'll be increasingly harder. I mean, we can't even tell the difference. What about yourself? How often do you use AI?
I'm also like one of those who have just started. I mean, I use it a lot, like most people, like advanced search engine.
Okay.
And I'm not like PM. PM is, I don't know whether you saw his clip recently. He's been doing coding, he's an Apple developer now, doing a step tracker. I'm not quite up there yet, but I'm using it for improving my speeches when I need to do that. It's been very helpful.
Did you use it to prepare for this podcast?
I did.
Did you ask like, what kind of questions they will likely ask me and how should I respond?
It's been helpful to sharpen my answers. I mean, there are things that sometimes, you know, you know a lot about something, you want to talk a lot and actually it's not crisp answer when it gets on media. So yeah, I mean, it's been very helpful. But I'm trying very hard to think about other things I can use AI for. And sometimes I have to ask my kids.
Are there things that you are wary about when it comes to using AI? Like, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, the good stuff. But are there, you know, personal things that you will be like, maybe I'll just be a bit more wary about?
Yeah, I mean, I think about what my kids are using their, you know, phones and their computers for. You know, you're in this slightly conflicted situation where you want them to use the new tool and be familiar with it, as I just said. At the same time, you know, you're not sure how far the tool will go. So yeah, that's something that we think about very seriously. We have to find ways to manage, and I think over time it will happen because a lot of the tech companies that I know are already thinking about this. So we'll see how that goes and how far they take that, but I hope that that's an area where we can develop quickly.
So much of it isn't about the technology itself, but how we use it.
Correct.
Often.
As you say, it's a tool.
It's a tool, exactly. But sometimes the tools can be so good that it does my job. And so people are concerned about jobs, right? Everyone's working thinking, okay. And also, I think it has been said how we always want our people to have good jobs. But increasingly, we're struggling to define what exactly are good jobs. Yeah, and will that change with the evolution of AI and all that coming into the picture? How are you going to say, I have a good job?
Yeah.
Well, I think the definition of a good job is both normative as well as objective. I mean, there are basic things you can look at. A good job should have fair and sustainable wages. It should have general employment stability, some sense of career progression, and it should be meaningful. It should mean something to you. But there's also the relative component, because what is a good job to you may not be a good job for me. I mean, some people like to work outdoors. I like to work outdoors more than indoors. You know, some people like desk jobs. So there is that relative component as well. But what we want to do is to make sure that we try to address as many people's aspirations as possible when growing the economy and creating jobs for Singaporeans. It's not entirely a one-way sort of effort, because individuals also have to make sure they are prepared to take on these new jobs, that they have the right skills, also have the right attitudes and train themselves to be able to take up these jobs. The difference between then and now, I think, is the pace of this adjustment. Because in the past, it used to be you come out from school, you are kind of readily equipped to take the job that is in the market. But today, the pace of change is much faster. The center of gravity is no longer just on what we call pre-employment training, not just in the schools anymore. We need to shift towards a situation where you are also training when you are in the job or in between jobs, post education. And that's why we have been investing in Skills Future. It's a long road. We've been, I think, 10 years plus now. And the idea is to get people to get comfortable with the concept of lifelong learning. We have to do it because the pace of change is just so fast. You have to pick up new skills.
But you know, people that we speak to say that I can't even qualify for an entry level job because there is no entry level job, you know, now that, you know, everybody's moving towards AI automation. So there is that fear that, let's not even talk about good jobs, that I don't even know whether there is a job. And then, you know, then the question is, oh, then go back, you know, go and upskill. And I guess fresh grads are also thinking to themselves, how much more learning should I do? Like, at some point, I just want to earn a salary. So how do you help these, you know, maybe this group of people feel that, okay, you are minoring in ChatGPT right now, but you will have something later on when you are
I think
about
the anxiety is real, and the anxiety is also extensive because, as I mentioned earlier, it affects everyone. It's not just the you know, rank and file entry level types. Even if you are a mid career professional, you've been in the job for 40 years, you could find that your job is changing, and your roles and responsibilities also change with technology. And we have to get people confident and I suppose comfortable with the likelihood that they will change. And when it changes, you actually are ready because you know how to train yourself to get better. I don't think there will be a point where we have to stop learning. There will not be a point where you say, okay, I'm done, you know, and I don't need to learn anymore. And that's not life. I mean, life is about really trying to become a better person, better at what you do. And it just means that for some of the jobs that are more fast changing, you have to keep up and to make sure you are able to do whatever is next.
But I would argue it's really about the adaptability and the flexibility, and that the younger generation have to think, you know, I may be skilled in this, but I have to learn how to apply it. So now I know how to do it, step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What if there was only step 2 and 4? Can I still solve the problem? You know, yeah. And I think when they can bring that mindset to it, using tools like AI to help them, that would be key.
If I were young, I would be very excited. Yeah. If I were my kid now entering, I would be excited because for a few things, you know, things are changing very quickly. There's no set precedence of how you should do the job like this. You can experiment, you can try. Maybe your skills are more relevant than the your predecessors who are doing it.
Yeah.
Second, I don't think my kid is going to be doing the same job as I have, you know, I have been doing the same job for 24 years as a civil servant.
Yeah, you might not even stay for 2 years, right?
So you're actually quite, you have a lot of options.
Also, maybe tell us, as we journey in this way, I mean, to get to the success story, often there are many failures before that. Can you share any examples of, you know, things that have been tried that didn't quite come to fruition, that had to be retweaked and retweaked to finally get what we have?
Well, I think there have been many cases where we've had to adapt. I think we, in particular, government is good at prototyping things, but we're not necessarily very good at achieving the final product.
Mm-hmm. So things might die at the beta stage.
May well be, because, I mean, it's a good idea, but you can't really execute it to perfection because you're not the best person to do it. And it's in large part because government is, you know, you're a specialized organization, you're supposed to be doing certain things, and you may not be able to get the right type of people to do the things. So I can give you an example. We, long time ago, we knew that the, you know, ride hail services were coming on stream. So we were thinking about building our own taxi app to help commuters know where taxis are. And, you know, we built it, but our app really wasn't very good. You had taxis in the sea, you know, that you could hail, which, yeah, in the end, we said, okay, maybe the private sector is a better place to do this, you know. And so in the end, we knew the idea was good, but it was difficult for government to execute because we don't have, we're not in the business of making money or in this case, providing a service. And in the end, it was better left to companies to do it. Right. So there are many examples like this.
And that's probably the best way, actually. You want to complement each other.
Yeah.
And that way, you support the private sector who builds it up, and, you know, if everyone's on the same page.
Yeah, that's right. That's, I think, a very good segue to my next question, which is, we're talking about this ecosystem, right? So you spoke about the government's efforts, you spoke about the workers' efforts, you spoke about all the education and training that, you know, you would like to roll out for us. But at the end of the day, where is the employer's role in all of this? Because the people that we speak to, I mean, we have another podcast, the Work It podcast, and, you know, people are always saying that I go for the upskilling, but that doesn't translate to higher wages. My employer may not actually recognize that I am getting skilled in AI, because the employer would say, oh, that's actually not what I want you to do. I wanted you to do something else. So how, so is there a, should we be putting a bit more pressure on employers to say, well, recognize these?
We have found that, you know, in cases of training, the training that is done together with the employers has the most sort of efficiency, maybe that's the best word for it, because it makes sense, right? You know, the employer wants this set of skills, it has its workers already there, they want to retrain these workers, and then government supports them in some way, and they achieve what they want to do. It's less efficient when individuals do their own reskilling, And then, you know, sometimes it maybe it's not what the company wants. The company may be able to use some of it, but not fully, either the right timing or the right skill set. And then the employee gets a bit, well, you get worried because, you know, I've invested all this money for training. You're not seeing the benefits. So there's a bit of that. So for some time, we've been trying to find the right balance between employer-led training and employee sort of initiated training. There isn't a perfect formula. I think you need both. You need the employee to sort of take his own initiative to do things. Sometimes being self-motivated is very helpful. You also need the employer to say, well, this is what I need. I want to do this, and then I'm prepared to put some money to
But the employer
support.
Will say, I need more money to put money into the higher wages. So who's going to give me that money?
Yes, indeed. So they have to do their calculations. I accept that, I understand also that for some SMEs, it's a bit harder. It's a bit harder because, you know, you are running your business, your margins are thin. Where do I have the time to train my workers? And can I afford to send the worker for training? So we have to make it easier. And we have been trying to do that over the years, but we have to make it easier for the SMEs to be able to, first of all, recognize that they need to send their workers for training. Second of all, to invest in the effort and to structure their work in such a way that they can do it, because it's also in their interest. They are competing with the world. They're not just competing with the companies in Singapore.
What about SMEs? Let's go back a little bit more. How do you convince a local company to go global? You know, because they're going to go, it's like, you know, my margins are already, you know, a bit lower, and
it's
every year I'm worried.
Yeah.
So how do you convince like local SMEs to go global? Because you mentioned their competition is really not local anymore. It's with, you know, the companies outside.
It's been something we've been pushing very hard for a long time. This budget, we are making a renewed push. And the reason for this is we know that it's getting much more difficult to compete overseas. You know, many other markets are now more protected. Other countries are doing industrial policies to push their own companies. For Singaporean companies, it will get harder, which is why in this budget, we've added more support for companies to go overseas through our grant schemes, and also facilitating their work in new markets, new areas where previously we did not. There is another disadvantage for Singaporean companies, which is that we are a very small market. So the runway for a Singaporean company is actually very short. It's a bit like a plane, you know. In, let's say if you were an American or Chinese company, you can grow up to a pretty big size with your domestic market before you have to go overseas. In Singapore, it's like after that, you run out, so shoop, you are out, and you are out having to compete with big companies in the world. And so I think we can do more to help our companies achieve scale quickly and then be able to compete in these more difficult markets. And that's what we want to do. But we have no choice. Because if you stick to the Singapore market, after a while, you just run out of business and room and you just have to...
But generally, we are quite risk averse.
Yeah,
I am quite risk averse.
Hence the term kiasu, right? But that's how it came
and
about.
Kiasi,
right?
Scared to die as well. Yeah, so
but,
I think
mean,
there's
so few of us in Singapore. That's true. If you just base your business here, there are not enough Singaporeans in a way to buy your product. So let's move on and talk about cost of living, because this is another big concern of everyone. But at the same time, everyone's favourite term, CDC vouchers. So it's come back again, and a lot of people are saying, hey, how, Tiffany, I think...
Is this the last year?
No, I think it's going to keep coming. They've got to keep giving it now.
Oh,
there's no way you can stop it now.
Is it going to end at some point?
Yeah, will that tap ever close?
Is it hard to turn off that tap already?
Well, first of all, I think we are very conscious that cost of living is very much on the top of mind for Singaporeans. Actually, for the most part, the support that the government gives is structural. Structural in the form of, you know, the key important goods in life, education, healthcare, housing. These are all subsidized and heavily subsidized. And we do have then temporary transient support like the CDC vouchers, which we give depending on the environment at the time and the economic situation at the time. I think that approach has served us well. But the most important thing is to keep the economy growing, make sure Singaporeans can take the good jobs that will be created in this new economy and then earn good wages and have a good standard of living.
So we will still get more vouchers?
That's a decision we'll take again next year.
Year by year. Yeah.
I want to talk about retirement as well. Because PM talked about retirement issues. Is there anything in this space that you're a little bit worried, you know, in terms of, or just concerned about the way we plan for our retirement? Do you think we are well taken care of? I mean, personally, I mean, aside from what the government is doing, do you think we are making the right plans for our own retirement savings?
Well, the retirement adequacy is very much top of mind for the government. We know it's also a big issue for Singaporeans, particularly as more of us age and, you know, reach a retirement, or not even close to reaching retirement, we are already worried. And so we have, in fact, relative to many countries, already a good system in the CPF, where many of us have the ability to, well, meet our retirement needs, but also meet our other needs, say healthcare, especially when you stop working, is a big burden. We have to make sure it keeps up, because when standard of living goes up, everybody's expectations go up, and maybe the amount that you have provided for before may not be enough.
Yeah.
And so we have to try to see whether we can support people to do more for themselves too as well. And this is the reason why in this budget we will talk a little bit more in detail at the MOM COS, the move that we are making, which is to introduce a new investment product through the CPF system.
Yeah. Actually, we want to ask you about that, the Lifetime Retirement Investment Scheme, because we know
that's the working name.
That's the working name, yeah, okay.
It can be shortened if you would allow me to make a suggestion.
Oh, it'll be CPFLRIS or something like that. We love acronyms.
We can do better.
The main question here is, so it's an investment scheme, and we know investments can never be guaranteed 100%.
Yeah.
So some people are concerned. They're saying, is my CPF money, my retirement savings, is this definitely good? Is this going to be good, or it can be bad, right?
Yeah. So it is a different product. So really, the idea is this, that if you are younger, you can have a certain risk profile. And so therefore, if you invest, you should be able to get higher returns. And then later on, as you get older, you should change your risk profile. And then therefore, you know, invest in more safer assets, your returns will be lower. But your risk will be also correspondingly lower. It's what we should do generally as individuals. Yeah. But we are just going to structure all that into one standard product and say, well, generally, it'll be like this. If you're entirely risk averse, if you say, okay, I don't want anything to risk at all, you don't have to take this. It's an option for now. You just essentially just stick with what it is in the CPF, where you have guaranteed the interest rates and guaranteed returns. But if you think that, well, on the long haul, you understand what this is about, you want to invest in this is a product that makes it easy for you to do so.
But is the data suggesting that we are not managing our own CPF investments?
There's a range
properly?
Of people. Mm. People manage their things differently. This is just providing another option to say that if you do this, you can get a little bit more than maybe the base CPF rate, but you have to take on a bit more risk.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's no guarantee except the current CPF rate.
Yeah.
But risk comes reward. If you take a bit more risk, you'll get reward. But the idea is to give you the option to do so.
So we talked about a lot of stuff, and I think there's a lot to digest and chew on. And of course, over the coming weeks, we'll have more information coming out about the different schemes and what it will really mean for people. So I think we'll be chatting more about it. So thank you very much, Minister, for coming in.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you. Enjoy the chat. Thank you very much.
All of you watching us at home, you know, if you have questions, I think if you have any concerns, any questions, do post them in the comments. We do love to hear from you. Otherwise, catch us next week for another episode of Deep Dive. Bye for now.
See you.
See you.